Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Well, good evening, everyone. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. If you haven't had the chance to look at Roseanne Cash's website, I encourage you to do so. It's a great site, but what I particularly enjoyed stumbling across was her official biography, which reads, "Roseanne Cash keeps her head down and shows up for work." Period. She's recorded 11 number one songs, won the Grammy for Best Female Country Performance in 1985, and has received 10 other nominations. We here at the Tattered Cover have had the good fortune to host Roseanne before, back in 1996, for her reading of Bodies of Water. And I think she's kept us waiting long enough for her return. We're delighted to welcome Roseanne back to the Tattered Cover to present the new edition of her best-selling memoir, Composed. Would you all please join me in warmly welcoming Roseanne Cash.
Good evening. Thank you. Thanks very much. Love being at an independent bookstore. I was the kid who asked to be dropped at the libraries on Saturdays, the geeky little girl who disappeared into books. So I always say librarians saved my life. I'm going to make a T-shirt that says that. I was here for the book, Bodies of Water, a book of short stories that I wrote in 95, 96. And my editor at Hyperion, Rick Cott, edited that book, and then he left and went to Viking. I was very sad. And I eventually broke my contract, asked them to break my contract so I could follow Rick, but I hadn't written anything for him. So I had lost my voice in 1998 for 2.5 years. I sounded like Tom Waits with a bad cold. I sounded like this, just talking like this. And I couldn't record, I couldn't sing, and I couldn't really write songs because every time I'd pick up the guitar and I couldn't sing to myself, it was so depressing, I put it down again. So I was pregnant, and I started this little cottage industry of writing essays for magazines. And I wrote for the New York Times and New York Magazine and the Oxford American and even Martha Stewart Living. Which was the hardest gig I've ever had, by the way. And I wrote this piece for a defunct magazine called Joe. And the piece was called The Ties That Bind. And it was about family and music, both contextually and conceptually. Families in music and families that play music. Families together and extended families. And about family as theme in country music and in Appalachian music. And of course I wrote about my own family in this as well. So Rick, my editor, calls me and says, "That piece is the beginning of a memoir." And I said, "No, it's not." And he said, "Yeah, it is. Just keep writing." I said, "But I don't want to write a memoir." And he said, "You are. You're writing a memoir." So he sent me the work of M.F.K. Fisher. And if you don't know who she is, she wrote about food. And the way she wrote about food is she wrote about her life by writing about food. She would write about a meal, but there would also be someone at the table. And there was a story behind the relationship. And then the other person who she picked the tomatoes with or bought the mustard with, and how she got to this location to have this meal. So it was very peripheral, but it was so elegant the way she wrote about her life with this centerpiece of food. So I said, I could write about my life by writing about songs. I could try to do that like MFK Fisher. So I tacked her picture above my desk for inspiration, and I started writing these short pieces about where the songs led me, what they meant, who I met because of them, the ones that led to true love, the ones that led to breakup, the ones that led me to discover my own family, my own ancestry, the ones I wrote and the out of joy, and the ones I wrote out of torture. And so the centerpiece of this whole book are these songs that are threaded through and what it means to be a songwriter. So 10 years went by, and I was doing other things. I was making records. I was having a baby. I was going on the road. And then a cataclysm of loss in my life. My loss in 3 years' time, I lost 3 out of my 4 parents and a stepsister and a couple of aunts and a couple of very dear friends. And it felt like the world was out of control. And then I got very sick, and I had to have brain surgery. And the year after brain surgery was miserable. And as I was lying on my couch in pain every day, I started thinking about what I wanted to do with my life. You get a good hard look at your own mortality, you start thinking about what do I want to do if I have a rest of my life. What am I going to do with it? And I thought, I want to finish this memoir. I felt so many people had co-opted my family's story, and that it had been so distorted in the press in so many ways, and so much, so many projections onto my father, particularly everybody wanting them to be who they wanted him to be, reflecting a part of themselves. And that happened within my whole family. It happens to me, too. I think it happens to anyone in public eye. But I never stopped to correct any misperceptions because I thought it was beneath my dignity. And also, there were so many stories. Which one would I set right? I would have to spend the rest of my life setting all of these stories right. But I thought, I have a right to put my own story out there. Everyone else has. I have a right to say what my experience has been, who I've met, what relationships were important to me, what songs, like I said, who I married, how I grew up, what led to all of this. And then I realized even more that if I didn't put my own story out there, someone else would co-opt that as well. So I told them, by this time I was signed to Viking, and I said, I don't know what you're expecting from a memoir, but I'm not going to dish dirt, and I'm not going to settle any scores, and I'm not going to intentionally hurt anyone. So if you're looking for that kind of celebrity memoir, you'll be disappointed. And Rick kept assuring me that's not what we want. And he's been a great kind of angelic guide through this whole process. So it came out last year. The other thing I wanted to do when I was laying on my sofa and thought about was make this record based on a list of 100 songs that my dad had given me when I was 18 years old. I went on the road with him directly after high school, and I grew up in Southern California listening to everything that was in the air in Southern California in the late 60s and the 70s, and I was president of my Beatles fan club, and I was obsessed with music, but I didn't care anything about country music or real roots music. So when I went on the road with my dad at 18, he mentioned a song, and I said, I don't know that one. And he mentioned another. I said, I don't know that one either, Dad. And he got alarmed. And he spent the rest of the afternoon making a list, sitting in the back of the bus, legal pad, no Google, legal pad, a pen, I could see him very pensive making this list, and at the end he titled it 100 Essential Country Songs. And he said, this is your education. That's all he said, this is your education. Well, I took that very seriously, and I knew I wanted to be a songwriter, and I saw that he was giving me a manifesto, the prototype, you know, and also that he was giving me himself, because this was really his heart. And it should rightly have been called 100 Essential American Songs, because it covered all of the feeder streams that go into the river of modern country music, Delta blues, Southern gospel, Appalachian protest songs, early folk music. And he said, as it's your education, you know, I had to learn them. And I did learn them. And I saved the list. I had the good sense to take that list with me wherever I moved over the next several decades and save it. But much like a recipe or a set of dishes or a jacket that your parent leaves you, you don't really think about it until they die. And then you go, oh, there's this list that Dad gave me. It becomes more than just this great list Dad gave me. So on the sofa that day when I said I want to finish my memoir, I also said I want to make a record based on the list, and I did both within a year. I thought I would read something to you from the book about my voice. Everybody thinks, oh, you just, you know, stepped right into singing. Oh, it must have come so natural to you, your family, your singers. I thought being a singer was the worst possible idea ever. Being a performer in general, but particularly being a singer. I was very shy. I was immersed in words. I wanted to be a songwriter and a writer in general, but I wanted to do it in a room alone and kind of set depth charges out in the world with my songs and my stories and not have anyone ever see me. And then I ended up making a record, a demo, and then a record of the songs and then going on the road. And lo and behold, I was a performer and a singer. It took me a long time to really reconcile my whole self with that. I thought of myself as a songwriter who incidentally sang. But then when I lost my voice, I said to myself, if I ever get it back, I'm not going to run those tapes of self-criticism all the time. I'm really going to appreciate it. And it was much like a friend that I met again in middle age. One day in 1988, I was lying on my couch in a sleepy reverie as the afternoon sun spilled through the huge bay window in the living room of my log house outside Nashville, when it occurred to me in a sharp, unsettling way that I was a singer. Not only was I a singer, but I sang for a living, which meant that a lot of people who were strangers to me were familiar with my voice without knowing me personally. They might not even know my name, but they had heard and now could recognize the voice, a product of my genes and experience, authentic but extremely personal in my estimation. This was largely how I felt about my voice, that it was undependable, beyond my control, somewhat embarrassing at times, if not too low, then too high, if not too soft, then too loud, or too harsh, or too wimpy. It was simply not enough, not right, and as such, it exposed me far, far more than I could comfortably allow. It presented the perfect conundrum, and therefore an irresistible career choice. My ambivalent relationship with my voice certainly had something to do with the fact that, thanks to my father's profession, our family was exposed to great singers who were also extraordinary personalities from an early age. My mother, for her part, was a devoted Patsy Cline fan and would say her name with slightly pursed lips, Patsy. No last name needed. Vowels squeezed a little by disapproval, but the tight mouth holding back a barely contained thrill. Patsy was wicked and fabulous when both qualities really meant something, before they became cheap ideas used to market more marginal talents. She was the object of fascination, distrust and raw, if hidden, admiration, but not judgment. There was nothing to attach judgment to because Patsy did not judge herself. She was too truly and spontaneously alive, too rooted in her body, too in command of a startling sexuality that infused everything and that was the vehicle for a preternaturally affecting voice that both revealed and obscured her essence. People who have genuine memories of her have become somewhat revisionist in their collective retelling. She was so great, also in the pre-marketing sense of the word, that they have felt almost obliged to polish and repair her wild and willful personality to suit the magnitude of her talent, particularly since she was a woman in an era that did not suffer female unaccountability gladly. I once asked Mom what she remembered about Patsy, not as someone who would have a professional take, for that I would have called my dad, but as a woman who had been so deeply affected by her. She laughed but didn't ask why I had posed the question. "I didn't know her well," she admitted, "but your daddy and I did have her over to the house not long before she died. She had a mouth like a sailor, and she didn't put on airs. She was just Patsy, comfortable in her skin. I admired that, but that beautiful voice and body were so different from her roughness." Mom paused. "I love her singing," she said passionately, present tense, and after considering the matter a while, added, "Well, she was very friendly." I laughed, my revisionist theory confirmed. "Were you disillusioned when you met her, Mom?" "Well, I wouldn't want that to be said. She was ahead of her time, that's all." There was a quiet pause and then a little sigh. "I never got pictures with her." Patsy Cline's gifts were extraordinary enough to have become a profound source of inspiration, even to those of us without immediate memories of her, those of us whose voices weren't so full-bodied and fully formed from the beginning, and whose values were not so exquisitely self-determined. In my private quandaries about my own voice, it gave me a lot of satisfaction to connect her teeming personality to the gifts she possessed. She lived a life utterly her own, messy and well-defined, and it all fed and merged with that voice. At the end of our conversation, I couldn't help asking, "Mom, was I at that party?" "Sure, honey. That was in, 1963. All you kids were born then." I sighed wistfully. Somewhere in the blackout of early childhood, I had had an encounter with Patsy Cline. I may spend the rest of my life trying to remember it. thank you. Yeah, so as you get older, you know, the things that you hold the farthest away from you, you suddenly hold the dearest. The opposite of what you thought was true becomes true, or they both become true. You know, I live in the gray more often than the black and white, definitely. And it's a great experience to be an author out on the road because there's no filthy dressing rooms or sound check, by the way. So when people ask me, "Why did you write this book now?" I say, "I didn't write it now. I finished it now." In the introduction, I say, "For my entire life, I have been trying to give voice to the rhythms and words that underscore, propel, and inform me. Because my peripheral vision is more acute than my direct powers of observation, and my love of an A minor chord is more charged and refined than my understanding of my own psyche, I have often attempted to explain my experiences to myself through songs, by writing them, singing them, listening to them, deconstructing them, and letting them fill me like food and water. I have charted my life through not only the songs I've composed, but the songs I've discovered, the songs that have been given to me, the songs that are part of my legacy and ancestry. Through them, I've often found meaning and relief, while at other times I failed to recognize or understand a rhythm or a theme until it became urgent or ingrained, and I finally came across a song that captured the experience. I've learned more from songs than I ever did from any teacher in school." But having said that, I wanted to read you a piece about... are there any Catholics here, by the way? Oh, dear. I do apologize in advance. My mother was a very strict Catholic, and I rebelled against it. It didn't work for me. I'm very happy. My daughter is now Catholic after all of this, and I'm very happy for her and for you, but, you know, I'm some pagan other place. I'm my own pagan baby. Do you remember in the Catholics, do you remember the coin box that you used to put coins in for the pagan babies to send to the pagan babies? I have one in my kitchen now. It says, I am my own pagan baby. The word contrition comes from the Latin word for bruise or grind, a derivation that makes perfect sense to me as a former Catholic. Something in the drone and the rhythm through my faults, through my most grievous fault, which I said to a man behind a screen in a dark confessional booth for so many years, was uniquely compelling. It took me many years to realize it wasn't my fault or even my grievous fault. However much I was drawn in by the swing of the words and the safe intimacy of confession. What all those anxiously droned acts of contrition chiefly accomplished was to break me down, bruising my sense of self permanently, or so I thought. In any case, they had the immediate effect of making me withdraw from the truth about myself for a very long time. The truth about me, as it turned out, was unacceptable, not only to Catholicism, but to adults in general. The truth about me was not meant to fit into the system of convent school, religion, contrition, or punition. None of that mattered. I was a writer. It would save me. One day in 1990, after I had finished my album Interiors and was beginning to write the songs for The Wheel, I went to my file cabinet and aimlessly pulled out a folder of papers my mother had recently sent me of my artwork, homework, and spelling lists from the seventh grade. Leafing through them, I came upon an English project I had done on metaphors and similes. Reading the piece, I vividly remembered the excitement I had felt on being given this particular assignment, for it was the very first time in my entire career as a student that I had been excited about anything the nuns had ever asked me to do. I read through my discussion of metaphors and similes, and I could feel the thrill of my 12-year-old self coming off the page, a nascent writer in love with language, as if language were a potential lover. I came to a single page that said, in big letters I had printed very, very carefully, "A lonely road is a bodyguard." It was a metaphor I had invented. And I was pleased with myself for having chosen this powerful image over the more straightforward simile, "A lonely road is like a bodyguard." I lifted that sentence from my seventh grade project and put it directly into a song I was writing, "Sleeping in Paris." "I'll send the angels to watch over you tonight, and you send them right back to me. A lonely road is a bodyguard if we really want it to be." That song ended up on The Wheel. And whenever I hear it now or think of it or sing it, I nod to my little girl self. And she, in the wisdom of her great distance and perspective, looks on with pleasure and the patience of one who has waited a long time to be noticed. This one line and this one song is how I know who I am and how I know I survived.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.